Chapter 81. Jesse. Cairo, Egypt, March 1919. Zara pushes through the throng of patients and leans out the clinic's window. The shouts and clanging of metal on metal grow louder as the crowd pushes down the street, the brays of donkeys and ding of bicycle bells adding to the cacophony. "What's happening, Zara? It's a racket out there," Jesse shouts from behind the curtains, separating the two examination rooms from the waiting patients. She ties up the bandage over a boy's hand and pats him on the head. "Sounds worse than a bunch of Aussies after a football match," Ivy shouts from the other examination room. The door flies open and Aziz strides into the clinic, his face streaming with sweat. "Aziz!" Zara exclaims. "What are you doing here?" "Where's Jessica?" Jesse pulls back the curtain and ushers the boy into the arms of his mother. "I'm here. What's going on?"
Saad Zalul and two of the other leaders of the independence movement have been arrested and deported to Malta. The city has gone crazy. The British are setting up machine gun posts at the major junctions. You have to get out of here.
Ivy pokes her head out from around the curtain.
Bloody hell. Oh, I don't want to get caught in the middle of that, Jesse. We'd best scarper.
What about our patients? Aziz claps his hands and shouts at the crowd of patients in Arabic. Zara opens the door and waves for them to hurry out of the clinic.
Good, Aziz says, as Zara locks the door. Collect everything you need. We must leave now. Mustafa's waiting in the car.
Mustafa squeezes the horn, but the harsh squeal does little to part the crowd. The car inches forward through the baying protesters. At the bottom of the citadel, they drop Ivy off. "Are you sure you'll be all right, Ivy?"
"Right as rain, Jesse. Safest place to be in a riot is a fortified palace, don't you think?"
She kisses Zara and Jesse on their cheeks.
"Get home safe. I'll ring you tomorrow."
The car heads back into the streets, turning down alleyways to avoid the crowds on the main streets.
"Jessica, you can't go back to the clinic. It's not safe."
"Surely this will calm down in a few days, Aziz."
"Not this time."
"It's true, Jessica."
Zara reaches into her bag and, taking out a leaflet, hands it to Jesse. "It calls for the women of Egypt to support the nationalists."
"You're part of this."
Aziz rests a hand on Jesse's knee.
"We both are. That is why we both know how much danger you are in as an Englishwoman. The clinic must stay closed. It may be some time before it can reopen, if ever."
"I set up the clinic, Aziz, and I'm the only one who can say if it opens or closes."
Aziz glances at his sister, who turns to look out the window.
"Jessica, we shall discuss this later. Your safety and the safety of my sister are paramount. The clinic will remain closed."
Jessie folds her arms and stares out the window as the anger rises inside her. She twists her wedding ring around her finger.
There is nothing she wants to do more in that moment than pull it off and throw it in the Nile.
Leila Khalid waves away Mustafa's attempt to refill her tea glass and fixes her amber gaze on her son.
"Mohammed has been nowhere to be seen today, and his son has left the gatehouse unattended. It's simply unacceptable, Aziz. Any of that riffraff could have stormed in here today. You must let them go. There are many others who can do their gardening work more cheaply as well."
Aziz looks up from his meal of Marta's lemon roasted chicken.
"My father hired Mohammed 30 years ago, Mama. I am not about to fire him or his son for missing a day of work."
Layla's beautiful mouth twists into a sour pout.
"They cannot be permitted to leave Altamanina at the mercy of the protesters. Do you wish your mother to be kidnapped, raped, and murdered by these Egyptians?
Zara drops her fork onto her plate.
Mama, I know that you carry the Turkish and Albanian blood of the old Khedive, as you are forever reminding us. But Papa was Egyptian. Aziz and I carry Egyptian blood in our veins. Do not insult the Egyptian people like this.
Layla raises a fine arched eyebrow at her daughter.
Don't tell me you are one of these nationalists.
She spits the word out like a poison.
You will be out on the street, waving a flag with the students and labourers before long.
She glares at Aziz.
Is that what you want, Aziz? Your sister out on the streets with these hoodlums?
Zara is free to do as she wishes. Layla shifts her gaze to Jessie.
This is all her fault.
Jessie looks across the table at her mother-in-law. My fault? How is that? Zara glances at Jessie.
You cannot blame Jessica for the riots, Mama.
Layla throws out her arms, her bracelets jangling.
She has led my daughter into the filthiest part of Cairo to work in that hideous clinic. If people cannot pay for medical care, they should stay home.
Jessie clears her throat. Madam Khalid, if the country's poorly paid labourers, farmers and factory workers, many of whom are women, fall ill and become incapacitated or die, this country will quickly fall apart.
Is that so? But you're British, and the British are our so-called protectors. Are you such a disaffected Englishwoman to be speaking treason?
Jessie tosses her napkin onto the table.
I am quite a proud Englishwoman. However, I do not agree with all the British government's decisions and directives.
Layla waves her hand dismissively.
Unfortunately, the British are a necessary evil in Egypt. They have built factories and cotton farms so everyone can find work unless they are lazy. If it wasn't the British, it would be some other country running Egypt. I only wish it were the Turks again. That was Egypt's golden age. There are children working in these factories, Madam Khalid. These factories are dirty and unsafe. We have people streaming into the clinic every day with injuries from the faulty equipment. They're all so worried because if they can't work, they aren't paid, even though it's a pittance. If they're not paid, they don't eat. I won't even begin to tell you the condition of the hovels they're crowded into, with no sewage or water. It's shameful. I'm ashamed that my government has a hand in all of this. The clinic must stay open. The people need us.
Zara claps her hands.
Bravo, Jessica.
Layla glares at her daughter.
Aziz, tell your sister she is forbidden to have anything more to do with that place.
I shall do no such thing. He throws down his napkin and pushes away from the table.
If you excuse me, I have had quite enough of this.
Penny for your thoughts. Aziz turns away from the view of the river at the back of the garden.
I am sorry, Jessica. My mother can be a difficult woman. And you can be a difficult man.
She walks across the lawn to join Aziz under the purple-blossomed branches of a jacaranda tree. She slides her wedding ring off her finger and holds it up to Aziz. I wanted to throw this in the Nile this afternoon. I was that angry with you about the clinic.
I am sorry, Jessica, but it is not safe.
I understand, but I don't take kindly to being bossed about, Aziz.
I was simply thinking of your safety.
He looks out at the sluggish brown water of the Nile. The students are calling for a general strike. There are reports that the British forces have shot and killed demonstrators in Tanta. It is going to get much worse, Jessica.
But the people will need us more than ever.
Not if you are kidnapped. Or worse.
What am I supposed to do? Just give up?
He takes her ring and slides it back on her finger.
Just for now, until the situation calms down.
I meant to stay here in the house with your mother. How do you think that will work out?
Jessica, why don't we leave Cairo? Go visit your family in London. It can be the honeymoon we never managed to take in Luxor.
He rests a hand on her belly.
Maybe we can work on another project together.
Jessie places her hand over his.
My mother isn't happy about our marriage, Aziz. She considers you a heathen.
You've read her letters.
Yes, I'm very sorry about that.
Don't be. I have no regrets. I never wanted an ordinary life.
Every day I wake up not knowing what the day will bring, and I love that. I love working at the clinic, feeling useful. Don't ever be sorry. I love you, Aziz, even if you are a difficult man.
He leans his forehead against hers.
I love you too, my difficult wife, more than you will ever know.
Chapter 82. Seeley. Clover Bar, London, March 1919. Seeley flops onto the sitting room chaise longue and riffles through the stack of letters. Christina looks up from her chair where she is working on an embroidery.
Anything interesting in the post today?
Well, what do you know? A letter from the prodigal daughter.
Which one?
Jessie.
What does she have to say?
Seeley tears open the envelope and scans the letter.
Oh, they're coming here. Jessie and her husband.
Here? To Clover Bar?
They're arriving in the middle of April for a month. It appears there are problems in Cairo.
What kind of problems? With their marriage?
No, Mama. Riots. Political problems. It appears the Egyptians want independence from the British.
Why ever would they wish that? Doesn't everyone wish to be British?
Not everyone, Mama. We've just come through a war. The Germans, Austrians and Turks most certainly did not wish to be British.
And look what happened to them. That attitude didn't do them any good, did it?
Christina sets the embroidery aside.
I shall go speak to Hetty about changing the menu for Easter lunch. I believe Dr. Khalid will not appreciate ham.
Seeley waits until her mother leaves the room. Then she opens up the envelope Jessie has enclosed, addressed to her.
Dear Seeley, please sit down. There is something I have to tell you. You have heard me mention my friend Ivy Roach in my letters before. I met her when we were nursing on the Letitia at Gallipoli. One night, a young German was brought on board, very badly wounded, with a bullet wound to his chest. Aziz did his very best in the operating theatre, and the soldier managed to make it through the operation. I'm not proud of this, but I'm afraid I refuse to nurse him. You know what I was like. I've changed, Seeley. I'm not the same person I was before the war. I'm so sorry about everything I said before I left. Ivy, being a much kinder, better person than me, nursed the German soldier. I wouldn't have thought any more of it, except that Ivy found a letter in his uniform after he died. She gave it to me yesterday. She has decided to go back to Australia. I don't blame her in the least. Things have got quite bad here in Cairo. Anyway, she asked me if I might try to find the girl in the letter. He'd written to an English girl, you see. I told her it was like looking for a needle in a haystack. Then I read the letter. Seeley, it was meant for you. Your loving sister,
Jessie. December 25th, 1914. My darling Shatzi, it is Christmas Day and my heart is happy. Why is this? I have just met with some British and French soldiers on No Man's Land. What is this? You may well ask. Have you lost leave of your senses, Max? No. The most wonderful thing has happened. The front has been quiet for several weeks, with not much to do, so Fritz and I found a small fir tree in the woods, and we stuck it up on top of the trench. Soon, several more trees sprung up. Some of them hung with bottle caps and buttons, feathers. It was quite a jolly forest. We were given extra rations of beer for Christmas and had a Christmas sing-along last night. You can imagine, it got rather lively. A few of the Tommies started singing along to O Tannenbaum, but in English, of course. They were quite terrible singers, and we let them know it. This morning, Fritz did a crazy thing. He jumped up onto No Man's Land and waved over at the Tommies, shouting, "Merry Christmas! Merry Christmas!" I think he was still drunk. I tried to pull him back, but he wasn't having any of it. Before I knew it, some of the Tommies had jumped out of their trenches, holding up bars of chocolate and knitted scarves. We all started crawling out of the trenches, taking anything we could think of to exchange as souvenirs. I exchanged my Landsturm cap with a Tommy from London. Fritz and my friend Dieter rolled out a barrel of German beer, and some of the French fellows had champagne. We exchanged cigarettes and uniform buttons, jam, anything we could think of. It was quite something to see. Shatzi, if the soldiers had anything to do with the war, it would be over tomorrow. I hope you are having a good Christmas with your family. Please give my best wishes to your parents and your two sisters. Please don't worry about me. I think about you every day and dream of the day we shall be together again. As long as I know you are in the world, I am happy. I must go now. One of the Tommies has a football they call Corporal, and we are going to play football on No Man's Land. All my love, always. Your Max. Celie's hand shakes, and the letter slips from her fingers, floating like a white leaf to rest on the sitting room's Persian carpet.
Cecilia, have you seen my knitting bag? I was sure I left it by my chair, but I haven't been able to find it anywhere.
Christina stopped short beside the chaise longue.
Cecilia, what has happened?
Celie wipes at her eyes and looks at her mother through a wet blur.
Max is dead, Mama. He's dead.
Chapter 83. The Fries. Clover Bar, London. April 1919. Jessie places her hand on her husband's as he is about to ring the doorbell of Clover Bar.
Aziz, this may not be easy. You know how my mother feels about our marriage. I apologize in advance for any offense she may cause.
The corners of Aziz's eyes crinkle as he smiles. You do not need to worry on my account, Jessica. What she said was out of love and concern for you, and from fear and misunderstanding of me as an Egyptian Muslim. He holds up an exuberant bouquet of white lilies. I intend to assault her with such a charm offensive that she will be compelled to accept me into the family, even if she feels it is against her better judgment. It won't be easy.
You capitulated, didn't you?
Quite right. Mama won't stand a chance.
She presses the bell.
Here goes nothing.
Christina pours out a steaming cup of Earl Grey tea. Milk, Dr. Khalid? Sugar?
Thank you, Mrs. Fry. Just black, please. Black, indeed. She offers him the teacup. I must thank you for the flowers, though in England lilies are generally understood to be funeral flowers. Jessie glares at her mother over her teacup. Mamma? Forgive me, Mrs. Fry. I was not aware of this custom. I have always found lilies quite elegant, and as Jessica has often spoken to me about her mother's elegance, I felt that they were the only flowers which would do you justice. Lily's mouth twitches.
Jessie, pass Dr. Cully the cucumber sandwiches, would you? You have no issue with eating cucumbers, Dr. Cully.
Aziz takes a crustless sandwich from the tiered curate stand. I am quite fond of cucumbers, Miss Fry. Our gardener grows them in our garden in Cairo.
We grow a variety of vegetables in Cairo, Jessie says, as she helps herself to an egg sandwich. Tomatoes, radishes, lettuce, peas. The soil is quite rich beside the Nile. Papa would be proud.
I did wonder what you ate there, Jessica, Christina says.
The food in Egypt is delicious, Mama. So full of spice and flavour. We have a wonderful cook named Marta who's been teaching me.
Celie coughs on her tea.
You? Cook? That's something I'd like to see.
Christina looks across the table at Celie. Cecilia, why don't you share your news? Jessie looks at her sister.
What news?
Celie sets down the walnut square.
I'm getting married to Frank Jeffries.
Jessie's teaspoon clatters onto her saucer.
Frank Jeffries? Seriously?
Yes. We've been corresponding through the war. He proposed to me last May, but I said no because of Max. But then, when he wrote me... She sucks in a breath. I've grown fond of Frank. We're emigrating to Canada. It's a chance for a fresh start.
You're fond of him.
Do you love him, Celie?
Aziz rests his hand on Jessie's arm.
I'm sure she loves him very much, Jessica.
When I received your letter about Max, I was in pieces, Jessie. Max was such a part of me. I couldn't think about any other life but one with him. I showed Frank Max's letter. Frank said he'd been there that Christmas, on the front. He'd played football with the Germans. He may even have met Max. Isn't that incredible? He's been so kind.
Still,
I have to move on with my life, Jessie. We're getting married at the end of May. You'll stay for that, won't you? I really wish you would.
Jessie glances at Aziz, who nods.
Of course we shall. Like you say, it's a fresh start.
I'm all for fresh starts.
Chapter 84. Christina and Celie. Clover Bar, London, May 1919. Christina stands in the doorway of her eldest daughter's bedroom and watches Celie pin the white veil over her auburn hair. Her heart leaps at the sight of her daughter in her white wedding gown, knowing how much Gerald would have wanted to be here on Celie's special day.
How can it be that this is Cecilia's wedding day? Wasn't it just yesterday that I held her in my arms on the ferry from Capri?
She catches Celie's gaze in the mirror's reflection.
Mama, you startled me.
Celie turns around on the cushioned stool.
What do you think?
Stand up so I can get a proper look. Celie stands and twirls in front of her mother, the fine lace veil fluttering around her.
You look lovely, Cecilia. Frank is a very lucky young man.
But something's missing. Celie looks down at the white silken lace dress with its fashionable dropped waist.
Something's missing?
Christina holds up a long string of creamy pearls. These were your grandmother Isabella's pearls. I wore them on my wedding day. They were her mother's. Now they're yours, to give to your daughter one day. Celie runs her fingers over the cool, round pearls as her mother fastens the clasp behind her neck.
They're lovely, Mama. Are you sure?
They're for the eldest daughter of the eldest daughter. Christina turns Celie around and stands back to appraise her.
You are a lovely young woman, Cecilia. Your grandmother would be proud of you.
I'm sorry I never met her.
She was a woman with a very strong will. She insisted on living the life she wanted, even if it meant alienating her family.
She sounds like the twins.
Christina runs her hand along Celie's cheek. Cecilia, I know I haven't always been as supportive of you as I might have been. You've always been so self-sufficient. I felt the twins needed more guidance. Jessica's stubbornness and Etta's irresponsibility caused me no end of worry. Anyway, you were always your father's favourite. You didn't need me.
Mama, there were times I felt you didn't love me as much as the twins, that somehow I was a disappointment to you.
Christina feels tears prick at her eyes. I'm sorry, Cecilia.
Celie kisses her mother's cheek. It's all right, Mama. There's nothing to be sorry for. You're my mother. I love you.
The image of Harry Grenville's youthful face flashes into Christina's mind.
You should have been here, Harry. Your daughter is getting married. Our daughter is getting married. I shall never forgive you for what you did, but I've been wrong to take it out on Cecilia. It's not her fault that you're her father. The fault is all ours.
She dabs at her eyes with her handkerchief and smooths the veil over Celie's shoulders.
At least one of my daughters is marrying a nice young Englishman, even if he is Church of England.
She squeezes Celie's hand.
Are you ready, my dear?
Yes, Mama. I'm ready.
Frank turns to watch Celie walk up the long aisle of St. Mary the Virgin Roman Catholic Church, arm in arm with her mother. His nerves, which have only been heightened by his first foray into a Catholic church, settle at the sight of Celie in her white dress and veil, smiling at him like a beautiful auburn-haired angel. The sonorous organ music soars through the nave. The memories of the long years of war and all the death he has seen momentarily fade, and his heart quivers with happiness. Celie slips her hand into his and squeezes his fingers lightly.
Hello, Frank.
Hello, Celie.
It will all be all right.
Chapter 85. The Fries. Clover Bar, London, May 1919. A pounding on the bedroom door.
Aziz, please, come quickly, Aziz.
Jesse sits up in the bed. It's Celie. Aziz pulls on his dressing gown and opens the bedroom door. Celie and Frank stand in the hallway in their dressing gowns. Jesse joins Aziz by the door.
It's Mama, Jesse. She's been sick all night. There's something terribly wrong. I thought it might have been something she ate at dinner, but she has a nosebleed now, which won't stop.
Oh, Celie, you don't think it's... Frank gives Celie's shoulders a comforting squeeze.
I'm sure she'll be fine in the morning. We just thought it was best if you would take a look.
Yes, of course, Aziz says. I shall meet you in her room. Mrs. Fry, can you sit up?
Aziz checks Christina's pulse as Jesse holds a handkerchief against Christina's streaming nose.
There's a thermometer in my nurse's chatelaine, Celie. Give it to Aziz. Then you'd best leave us. Go wash yourselves. Use as much soap as you can, and wear the masks Aziz gave you.
Jessie, I want to help. Celie, please, I'm a nurse. I've seen the flu in Cairo. I know what to do. It's best if you leave, and close the door behind you.
Celie looks at Aziz.
It is the Spanish flu, then.
Aziz slips the thermometer under Christina's tongue.
Yes. Do you have aspirin? I don't believe so.
Ring the chemist in the morning and order some. Ask for salt of quinine and morphine as well, and more disinfectant. Tell them to leave the package by the door. Tell them we're in quarantine.
Jessie looks over at Frank.
Go wake Hetty, Frank. Tell her what's happened, and that we'll need boiled water, as well as a pitcher of cold water and some clean cloths. Ask her to boil some milk, with cinnamon for now. Tell her to wash and disinfect all the dishes and cutlery. Give her a mask to wear, and tell her to stay downstairs.
Christina grasps Aziz's hand as he removes the thermometer. Her body shakes as she is overcome by a fit of coughing. Red spittle stains the white sheets like dots of paint. She looks up at her son-in-law, and he sees the fear in her blue eyes.
Help me, Aziz.
I shall, Mrs. Fry. I shall do everything in my power, inshallah.
It's Il Polpo.
Christina looks behind her.
Harry, what are you doing at the market?
He shrugs.
Just soaking up the atmosphere.
He holds up his sketchbook.
Making some sketches. Doing what a tourist does.
The fishmonger dangles an octopus, its rubbery tentacles flapping, over his offerings of fresh shellfish and glistening fish.
Signorina, per favore, lo vuoi?
Si, si, octopus, il polpo.
Then they are walking along the cliff. She can feel the warmth of the summer sun on her face. She stumbles on a stone, and he reaches for her hand. Her heart drums in her chest. He is speaking of his visit to Pompeii, but she hears nothing but the low lull of his voice. The world is the touch of his hand. They are in the grotto. He presses her against the stone cobbles. When she opens her eyes, she sees nothing but the blue sky and a lone gull hovering high above them. Then the notes of a song float toward her over the air, a song of such exquisite beauty that she weeps.
Mrs. Fry? Mrs. Fry, can you hear me?
Christina blinks as her eyes focus on the stranger's masked face.
It's Aziz Khalid, your son-in-law. Mama?
Another face appears.
Jessica.
Jessie brushes her mother's forehead with her gloved hand.
I'm here, Mama.
I'm so sorry, Jessica.
It's all right, Mama.
Christina rolls her head from side to side, dampening the pillow with her perspiration.
It was wrong of me to judge you. You must love whom you must love.
She looks at her son-in-law.
Please forgive me, Aziz. I was wrong. So wrong.
Mama?
Celie enters the room, stifling a gasp when she sees her mother's blue-tinged face.
Mama, Etta's on the telephone with Adriana. She's calling from the post office in Capri. She received my telegram. I told her I'd give her a message from you. Frank's speaking to her now.
No. I want to speak to Etta. I want to speak to my daughter and my granddaughter.
Mama, you're too ill.
Aziz pulls back the sheets and lifts Christina into his arms.
This is important. Let's go.
He carries Christina down the stairs, followed by Jessie, as Celie races ahead. She takes the telephone receiver from Frank.
Etta, Mama's coming. Aziz settles Christina into the hall chair, and Jessie holds the telephone receiver against her ear.
Etta? Etta May? Are you there? It's Mama.
The line clicks and buzzes.
Mama, it's so good to hear your voice. How are you feeling?
I'm fine, my dove.
Adriana wants to speak to you, Mama. Adriana, Nana is on the telephone. Say hello in Italian for her.
A pause.
Nana? Si, il mio Angelo.
A giggle down the phone line.
Ciao, Nana. Io sono Adriana.
Christina clutches the receiver.
Ciao, il mio piccolo Angelo. Nonna loves you very much. I love you too, Nonna.
The line clicks and falls silent.
Adriana? Etta?
Christina presses the receiver against her chest.
I'm so sorry. I'm so very sorry for everything.
Frank takes the package from the chemist's boy and drops an extra coin into his hand with his payment. He re-enters the house and stands for a moment in the hallway. The faint murmur of voices wafts down from Christina's bedroom on the floor above, and dishes clatter in the kitchen where Hetty is washing up after breakfast. He opens the door to the study and shuts it softly behind him. Setting the parcel on Gerald's desk, he then pulls at the knotted string with his fingernails until it slowly unties. He spreads open the brown paper and sees what he is looking for amongst the medicine bottles. Morphine. 6 glass vials of his salvation. He slides 4 of the vials into his jacket pocket and carefully rewraps and ties the parcel. No one will ever know about the overorders of morphine, so long as he collects the chemist's deliveries. It's best that way. They wouldn't understand that the morphine is one of the only things that makes his life tolerable. The morphine and Celie.
Jessie!
Celie knocks on Jessie's bedroom door 4 days later.
Jessie, Frank and I have just seen Mama. She's sitting up. The fever's broken.
Jessie drops her pen on the desk.
Hold on, Celie. I'll be right there.
She ties on her mask and hurries down the hall with Celie. She throws open the door to her mother's bedroom.
Mama, you're sitting up. How are you feeling?
Christina smiles weakly.
What a question, Jessica. How do you imagine I'm feeling?
Jessie pushes past Frank and Celie and sits on the bed. She takes hold of her mother's hands.
You look so much better, Mama.
Celie joins Jessie on the bed.
We owe a great debt to Aziz, Mama. He's barely left your side since you became ill. He's a hero.
Aziz offers a glass of quinine-laced water to Christina.
Celie has a great imagination, Mrs. Fry. I was simply doing my job.
Christina swallows down the liquid with a grimace.
I do hope I don't have to drink much more of this, Aziz.
Jessie takes the glass from her mother.
Aziz, Mama? Not that Egyptian? Whatever are you talking about, Jessica? This young man is my son-in-law, and I intend to call him by his name.
Downstairs, the front doorbell rings.
That must be the chemist boy, Jessie says as she rises from the bed. I'll be back in a moment.
I'll see to it, Frank says as he heads to the door. Stay with your mother.
Thank you, Frank, Celie says. Mama, Frank and I have been talking. Once we leave for Canada, you'll be by yourself here at Clover Bar.
Nonsense, Cecilia. Hetty will be here.
It's not the same as family. Frank and I want you to come out to Canada once we've settled. We'll build a farm on our plot of land and make a fresh start.
She takes hold of her mother's hand.
It's all being paid for by the soldiers' land settlement scheme, Mama, and Frank's share of the auctioneering business, now that his father has retired. And I still have the money Papa left me. We'll have chickens and pigs, and I'll have a vegetable patch. Flowers, too, of course. Please say you'll come. Chickens, did you say?
And pigs, Mama, Jessie says. Won't that be fun?
Most likely a few cows as well, Celia says, for milk.
Cows and pigs.
Christina settles back against the pillows. Let me think about it, dear. But, Mama... Frank enters the room.
Celia, there's someone here for you.
For me? Who?
The young man steps into the room. His face is sharper, thinner, the face of a man rather than a youth. But his eyes are the same sparkling blue, his hair the colour of wheat in August.
Max!
Chapter 86.
Seeley. Clover Bar, London, May 1919. Seeley shuts the sitting room door and gestures to Gerald's favourite chair.
Have a seat, Max.
Her heart beats a drum in her chest as she turns to the door.
Would you like some tea? I'll ask Hetty, shall I? Tea would be good, don't you think?
Seeley. Shatzi. Stop, please.
Look at me.
Seeley turns to Max. And all the years of longing, of wanting nothing more than to be with him, to feel him against her, flood back.
Oh, Max.
Then they are in each other's arms, mouths seeking mouths, hands pulling at each other, in a world where no one exists but themselves. A soft knock at the door, and they pull apart. Seeley clears her throat.
Yes?
The door opens. And Hetty looks into the room, failing to hide her curiosity as she glances at the young German.
Made some tea, miss. Shall I bring it in? Yes, certainly, Hetty. Just put it on the table.
Max and Seeley stand awkwardly as Hetty sets down the tray. She watches Hetty shut the door behind her and turns to Max. He steps towards her and she holds out an arm.
Max, I'm sorry. We can't.
She shakes her head.
We can't. Why not? Nothing has changed for me, Shatzi. There wasn't one day in the past 4.5 years that I didn't think about you. You were with me every minute of every day. I wrote you so many letters, Seeley. I brought them for you. All of them. Here, in my bag. I love you, Seeley. I love you so much. Now we can be together, can't you see? Finally, we can marry, and nothing will ever separate us again. Oh, Max, I can't.
Her voice breaks.
I'm married.
Married?
But we were engaged.
Seeley sits down on the chaise longue.
I wrote you too, Max.
I imagined you reading my letters, wherever you were. I imagined finding your letters in the post and running up to my room to read them and reread them, over and over. I thought about no one but you, Max.
But in March, Jessie sent me one of your letters.
She was a nurse on a hospital ship at Gallipoli, and a German soldier had been brought aboard. He was very severely wounded, and he died. He had a letter on him for an Englishwoman that one of the nurses found. She gave Jessie the letter when she left for Australia. When Jessie read it, she thought the German soldier must have been you. Max sits beside her and takes hold of her hand.
But it wasn't me, Shatzi. When I read the letter, I knew it was you.
A tear runs down her cheek.
I thought you were dead.
It was my friend, Fritz.
He'd stolen the letter to tease me. He was always playing jokes like that on me. He brushes the tear away with his finger. What are we to do, Shotzi? I'm married, Max. I have a husband. He's upstairs, and I'm sure he's wondering what on earth is going on. I love you, Shotzi. I love you. I don't care. He grasps hold of her hands. Come with me. We can just go. Come to Germany. We can start over there. No one will know you are married. You didn't know, Seely. You didn't know I was alive. We were meant to be together. Nothing has changed for me, Shotzi.
Seely slides her hands from Max's grasp.
It's too late, Max. Everything has changed for me.
I'm married to Frank Jeffries. I'm going to Canada with my husband.
It's over, Max.
Max rises and takes a stack of letters tied with string out of his canvas bag. He sets it on the chaise longue beside Seely. At the door, he turns to her.
It will never be over, Shotzi.
Chapter 87. Seely and Jessie. Clover Bar, London. July 1919. Seely unties the black ribbon from around Gerald's portfolio and opens the red cardboard cover.
Did Papa ever show you this, Jessie?
Jessie looks up from the bed where she is packing her suitcase.
What is it?
Seely slowly flips through the pages of photographs.
Record of a tandem trip through Kent and Sussex, she reads.
Jessie looks over Seely's shoulder. Is that Mama? On the bridge?
Yes, in Ecclestone Glen.
And here we are, all three of us by the waterfall in Yorkshire that summer before the war. Etta fell into the water, do you remember? Jessie laughs. Yes. She was so cross. She'd spent half the morning arranging her hair to look like Mary Pickford's. Seely flips to the back of the portfolio and removes a photograph. She hands it to Jessie.
I've made a copy for you. I've sent a copy to Etta as well. No matter where we are in this world, we'll always be together, Jessie. You, me, and Etta. The Three Fry Sisters.
Chapter 88. Jessie. Cairo, Egypt, July 1919. Jessie pays the taxi driver and steps out into the dust of the Cairo street. The sun beats down over the city, the heat bouncing off the buildings until they are almost drained of colour. The riots and upheaval of the previous months have only recently quietened, with the British government's promise to consider an autonomous Egyptian government under British protection, though discontent and suspicion simmer under the oppressive heat, like a pot about to boil over. Clasping the rusty key in her hand, Jessie skirts the donkey carts and heads for the clinic's modest wooden door. She thrusts the key into the keyhole, twisting it one way and another, until the lock releases with a thunk. Inside, the clinic is dark, the smell musty. The shutters have been closed over the small windows and sheets thrown over the furniture. Sharp beams of white sunlight cut through the gloom like knives, illuminating the desert dust that has found its way through the building's crevices to coat every surface. She hangs her straw hat on a hook and, taking a deep breath, she turns to the task at hand. Jessie folds the final sheet and stacks it on the examination table. She wipes at the sweat, crawling down her forehead with the back of her hand, and unbuttons the cuffs of her sleeves, rolling them up to her elbows. She fills the old enamel sink that Ivy had rescued from the Citadel's hospital rubbish heap for what seems like the 100th time, and starts to attack the filthy tiled floor. What are you doing down there? Jessie looks up
at the sound of Aziz's voice. "Cleaning. I think half the desert sand got in here when we were away." Aziz shuts the door. "I'll arrange for some women to come and clean. You shouldn't have to come here on your own. It's still not safe."
"The demonstrations ended months ago, Aziz."
"It is a bandage on a gaping wound, Jessica. The situation is not resolved, whatever the women at the sporting club may say." Jessie gets to her feet. "Those old bats. They're all a bunch of self-important snobs with no interest whatsoever in Egypt or Egyptians. I have no intention of going back there."
"You can see why we Egyptians are so determined to throw off the British protectorate and govern ourselves."
"Yes, I can. I feel ashamed to be an Englishwoman here at times." Aziz takes the dirty sponge out of Jessie's hand and drops it into the sink. "There is no point feeling like that. You can't help the circumstances of your birth any more than I can. You can only be the admirable woman I love." Jessie stretches and rubs her back. "Aziz, you and Zara aren't still involved in any of that, are you? The British government won't stand for it. Egypt and the Suez are important to them. It's the British route to trade with India."
"Don't worry, Habibti. We are both very careful."
He pats the examination table. "Come, sit with me. I want to talk to you, away from my mother and my sister. If it's about me not running the clinic now that Ivy's gone, it is about the clinic. You know that I have never liked you setting up here in this part of the city." She sits on the table beside Aziz.
"I know, but..."
He reaches for her hand and threads his fingers through hers.
"It's not safe for you, Habibti. It would be a simple thing for you to be taken on the streets out there.
But I need to be useful, Aziz. I can't sit about twiddling my thumbs. I can't."
"I know this very well, Jessica. So, I have a proposition for you. The gatekeeper's house is empty since Mohammed's son has taken on that duty and prefers to live with his father in town. Its rooms are large enough for a clinic, and it is by the road, so it is accessible for people, and possibly less intimidating than coming through the garden to the house. It is much safer for you and Zara. And, if you are amenable, I shall join the clinic as the practicing physician."
"What about your job at the hospital?"
"The war is over. The soldiers have been sent home. Egypt is changing, and I am an Egyptian. I have been privileged, and my family has prospered under the Ottomans and the British. But my privilege has never sat well with me when I see the poverty in the cities and the countryside. I must join the struggle for an Egypt run by Egyptians. I've buried my head in the sand long enough."
"Are you sure? I thought you weren't all that happy about the clinic."
"No, I admire your passion and your stubbornness. I was simply worried."
"I can be awfully stubborn."
"Stubborn and willful and uncompromising and opinionated.
Fine. All right."
He laughs.
"And compassionate and tolerant and kind.
I always felt I was lacking in those qualities.
Not the Jessica Khalid I know. I am proud to be your husband."
Jessie smiles.
"The gatehouse would be perfect, Aziz. Perhaps we could use part of the garden for people to sit in and rest. There's such a beautiful view of the Nile. I've always thought it was such a pity that no one but us could see it."
"Whatever you wish, Habibti. I shall ask Mohammed to help you."
"What about your mother?"
"Mama will simply have to adjust to the new situation."
"She won't like it."
"No, she won't."
Aziz kisses her palm. "I love you, Jessica. You have my heart as long as you wish it.
You have made me a better man. Joy bubbles up inside of Jesse.
I love you too, you impossible man.
Laughing, Aziz hugs her close. Welcome home, Habibti.
Chapter 89. Etta. Villa Serenissima, Capri, Italy. July 1919. Etta adjusts the crown of summer flowers on Adriana's head and gives her a kiss on her plump cheek.
There you are, darling. You look like a pretty fairy, just like in the stories.
Adriana grabs the hem of her white dress and twirls around in front of her mother, the long blue satin ribbon at her waist swirling around her.
I'm a bride like you, Mama. One day, you'll be the most beautiful bride, sweetheart. Today, you're Mama's special flower girl.
Stefania hands Adriana a straw basket of rose petals.
You remember what Cousin Steffi told you, Adriana? When we arrive at the church, you'll walk up the aisle in front of your Mama and sprinkle the petals all around. Not till then. It's a very important job you have, il mio piccolo angelo.
Adriana nods, her dark eyes serious. She steps gingerly across the tiled floor toward the hallway, holding the basket out in front of her.
Where are you going, Adriana? To show Lily, Mama. All right, but no biscotti. We'll have cake after the wedding. She's growing up so quickly, Etta, Stefania says, as she watches Adriana skip out of the room. 4 years old, and she has Liliana and Mario wrapped around her finger.
Etta adjusts her own floral tiara over her long lace veil in the mirror.
They're not the only ones, Cousin Stefania. I wish my sisters and Mama could be here. And Papa. I know, cara mia. Your Papa is watching from heaven. I'm sure he is very proud.
Etta frowns at her reflection.
I'm sorry I missed Celia's wedding. Don't you think she should know about what happened when Mama was in Capri, now that Papa is gone? That is for your mother to tell her, Etta. You must promise me never to reveal to her that your Papa was not her father. Some secrets are best left buried. I suppose so.
Stefania brushes her fingers along Etta's cheek. It is out of her hands now. The Lord has seen fit to join her beautiful cousin in marriage to Carlo Marinetti. If only she could still the doubts about him that niggle her like a pesky fly. Ah, well, what can she do but pray that everything turns out well for Etta and little Adriana? She pulls a daisy out of Etta's tiara and stuffs it into her elaborate grey-streaked pompadour.
Cousin Stefania, whatever will Father Itzo say?
Our Heavenly Father cannot possibly object to a flower in a woman's hair at a wedding.
I shall tell Father Itzo as much. Now, I'm sure poor Carlo is wondering if you've run away with the sirens. It's time to go, cara mia.
Etta slips her hand into Carlo's and looks at him through the filmy lace of the veil. He rubs his thumb against her palm and smiles at her, his dark eyes glistening with emotion.
You are so beautiful, my darling, he whispers. You can't see me. I can see you in my mind, my beautiful angel. Everything will be all right now. We shall be a family.
Father Itzo clears his throat. Andiamo!
Carlo glances at the priest.
I am sorry, Father. You are right. We should start. We have been waiting for this day for a very long time.
Carlo weaves through the crowd of well-wishers, congregated in front of Santo Stefano. He lifts Adriana into his arms and grasps Etta's hand.
Come with me.
Where are you taking them? Stefania objects. We have the reception at the villa.
Half the town would be there.
Don't worry, Stefania. We shall be there soon.
He walks past the flower vendors and vegetable stalls on the piazzetta as Adriana tosses the last of her rose petals over the square. Vendors and customers call out, "Congratulazioni!" and "Bella sposa!" as they pass, in awe of the golden-haired bride's beauty and the pretty little flower girl. When he reaches the colonnade of Doric pillars which edge the terrace and frame the view over the marina, he gives Adriana a kiss on her cheek and sets her down.
"Can I kiss Mama now, Adriana mia?"
"Yes."
The little girl frowns.
"I don't have flowers to throw at you."
Carlo takes a shiny coin out of his pocket.
"Go to the flower seller over there. Tell her you need petals for the bride and a pretty flower for the flower girl."
Adriana peels off toward the flower seller with a delighted squeal.
"You spoil her, Carlo."
"I have every intention of spoiling both of you for the rest of my life."
Etta brushes her hand against his cheek.
"My husband, you have no idea how much I've wanted to say that, and for it to be true."
"My wife, my darling Etta, my beautiful siren, I love you so much. Nothing will ever take me from you again."
Chapter 90. Sealy, HMS Melita, Atlantic Ocean, July 1919. Sealy rests her elbows on the side of the old gunboat and lifts her face to the cool Atlantic wind. Behind her, the sails on the towering masts flap like wings as they catch the breeze, and the single funnel puffs out a plume of black smoke. On the horizon, a white spot appears, growing larger as the ship clips through the grey waves. Overhead, the sky is clear blue, the colour of the spring forget-me-nots in the flower beds at Clover Bar, and transparent clouds hang in the sky like veils. She glances over her shoulder, then, seeing no one there, she reaches into her handbag and takes out a letter. The thin paper is torn and dirty, and in places the black ink has dried into illegible puddles where her tears have fallen. She knows it almost by heart, as well as all the others.
"There you are, Sealy. I've been looking all over for you."
Sealy quickly folds the letter. "Frank, you startled me." She points at the iceberg, which has grown to a gleaming blue-white tower, just off the starboard side of the ship.
"Isn't that something? It must be very like the one the poor Titanic hit just before the war. I must get my camera. There's another iceberg on the horizon."
Frank glances at the letter. "What are you reading?" Celia stuffs the letter into her handbag.
"Just a letter from an old friend."
"Max?"
"What?"
"It's from Max Fisher, isn't it? I've seen the stack of letters at the bottom of our trunk. I read some of them."
"Frank!"
"I know. I'm sorry, Celia. I shouldn't have. I know that." He peers out at the horizon. "Do you remember I told you I'd played football with the Germans during the Christmas Day truce in 1914? Celia looks at Frank. His face is thinner now, after the long years of the war, though still handsome in its unassuming way.
"Yes, I remember.
I exchanged my hat with a friendly German chap. I offered to trade a uniform button for one of his, but he was already missing one. He said he'd given it to his fiancée the last time they'd seen each other, because he didn't have an engagement ring. He didn't want to give any other buttons away. He said it was special. He spoke excellent English." He looks at Celia. "It was Max." Celia's face blanches. She opens her handbag and retrieves a small kidskin purse. She opens up the clasp and takes out Max's brass button. She hands it to Frank.
Gott mit uns, he reads.
God is with us. It was the last thing he gave me before he left for Germany.
Celie, do you regret marrying me? Now that you know Max is alive,
I don't want you to feel that you're trapped with me. I would never want that.
Celie takes the brass button from Frank and holds her arm out over the churning waves. Frank grabs her hand. Don't.
Why not?
I know you loved Max, and you would have married him if things had been different. I think you still love him.
Celie looks at Frank, at the pain and uncertainty in his brown eyes. She does still love Max. A part of her will always belong to him. But Frank is a good man, and he is her husband. She will come to love him, she has no doubt. In a different way. Maybe in a better way.
Frank, I'm here. I'm with you. I've made my decision.
I love you, Celie. I hope you might love me too, someday.
You're a good man, Frank. I know you'll be a wonderful husband and father to our child.
She rests her hand, with Max's button still in her palm, on her belly.
We'll have a Canadian baby. Fancy that.
A baby? You're having a baby?
We are, Frank. We'll start over in Canada. The war is behind us. Europe and Britain are behind us. It's a fresh new chapter. The story of Celie and Frank.
Epilogue. Christina, September 1919.
Cioccolato, Signora Fry?
Grazie, Giulia. You know chocolate cannoli is my favourite.
Sì, sempre il tuo preferito, Signora.
Christina pays out the coins and collects the paper bag of cannoli. She packs it into her straw shopping basket with the parmesan, and waves at the shop assistant.
Grazie. Ciao, Giulia.
Prego, Signora Fry.
Christina opens the door of Taroni's delicatessen and steps out onto Clerkenwell Road. The last of the summer's sun has been swallowed up in a steady drizzle of rain, and she pauses under the shop's canopy to unfurl her umbrella. She heads left toward Farringdon Road and the train station, dodging the puddles and the office workers heading homeward. At the junction with Farringdon Road, Christina waits for a break in the stream of automobiles and horse carts. Then, shielding herself from the rain with her umbrella, dashes across the road. She rounds the corner and, intent on avoiding a large puddle, ploughs directly into a man hurrying from the station.
Oh, I'm awfully sorry.
Tina?
There's no mistaking the blue eyes.
Harry.
That was Love in a Time of War by Adrienne Chin. Read by Ruth Sillers. Produced by Paul Pink at RNIB Studios, Camden. This has been an audiobook from One More Chapter, a division of HarperCollins. Text copyright 2022. Production copyright 2022 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Adrienne Chin asserts the moral right to be identified as the author of this work. Thank you for listening.